have our agent's licensing records on our computer also. But you mean on the each complaint?
May I respond to that, Representative Chairman? The information that we have currently, if I can start back a little bit to explain how this arose. In 1976 is when the department first went on system with an automated program to record the inquiries as they came in and attempt to classify them as they were received or resolved in the department. The statute requires just that we record the items as they come in and be able to cross-reference them. And we attempted, in order to review the information as a red flag for us in working with companies or agents or really what's going on within the industry, to break that down into a finer category. And so this is really raw data going in, and it's based upon the public service officer who is reviewing that file and how he classifies the information when it is received. This also is true when you get down to the point of the resolution of the matter. The claim may be closed, and the company may have paid the claim as a result of our corresponding one. But that's also because possibly the insured hadn't gone back and furnished additional information to the company.
What I'm asking, I guess, Mr. Chairman, is off this form, I assume you have somebody inputting name, address, insurance company name, policy number, type.
That's correct. We do have.
So that is all part of the database that from which you withdrew that run that you showed us.
The initial information that you show right there at the front, the inquiry sheet that there is, input by a clerk within the office right now or by the public service officer who happens to be working with the client.
And you also have these categories, which will give you some broad generalizations, including others.
That is correct. And the individual normally will check those categories that you're referring to.
And then how is disposition marked on here?
On the reverse side of that form is really a worksheet that we work with, and there you'll notice a number of categories that we have gone down the side in order to aid us in our work in determining.
So if I understand this correctly, then all of this information, at least some portion of this information and some part of this information, is going into a computer system.
That's correct.
The computer system I work with, I don't know what yours is like, but the one that I work with would allow me very quickly to call company name and punch about three or four different calls, and I could have all this information up right on the screen and under company name, including, I would assume, disposition.
Yeah. Representative Bennett, Mr. Chairman, that's correct. The computer can do it.
Yeah.
There's no, well, I don't think.
Well, I'm curious about the $39,000 fiscal impact.
Well, I think the thing that.
What is this $39,000 biennium person doing to earn the money to withdraw the record? That's all we're saying, is how do you withdraw the record from your existing computer system?
The type of information, Mr. Chairman, that was requested here, where you had a descriptive summary of the complaint, that is not on the descriptive summary is not on the computer.
Okay.
It would have a code that would identify whether it's a automobile complaint or whatever it is, but the summary itself and a description of the resolution, but it's not on the computer. That would have to be taken off the actual records.
So you would need to have line 9 removed from the bill, and you could do it immediately with your existing computer information on file.
I don't believe so. It could be programmed for that, I believe.
Well, the reason
but
I'm
right
asking
now
is
we don't, you know, in order we get certain reports off the computer like we do now, but in order to have them pull the name off of each one of these for a listing, no, I don't believe without additional programming that we could just have a report run off. It could be programmed for that matter.
Joe, could you tell me what happens when initially you get a phone call from someone that may want to put in a complaint? Do you take, at that point, do you take it any further than just sending them out the form to fill out and then waiting for them to send it in, or what happens?
Mr. Chairman, Representative DeBoer, there are many times when I get a phone call and it's such urgency that I pick up the phone like I did yesterday and get a problem resolved for someone on the telephone. Ordinarily, what we do, especially if it's going to involve a health condition, we like to have them send us something in writing giving us permission to look at their health records or to get their records from whoever we may have to get to resolve the complaint.
So if we were to go to this bill, you would, instead of answering those ones quickly on the phone, have to take time to do all the paperwork and the whole thing to enter into that to make that the statistics even work.
Yes, we believe we would. It would involve a great deal of time.
I think your analysis is pretty close on if you're going to have to do all that handling.
Further questions for Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman. You get 400, you said 400 complaints or inquiries a month?
We open about 450 files each month. Some of those are more easily resolved than others.
How many are complaints where you would say this is a complaint? I'm sure some people call and say, I just don't understand my policy. What does this mean?
We ordinarily don't open a file on the ones that we can answer very simply. There have to be some investigation or some correspondence or going back and forth.
So it's you then get 400 complaints a month against the insurance companies operating in Oregon?
Not necessarily companies. It could be complaints against an agent. It can be...
They're all complaints.
We get... All right. It just depends. Sometimes they're not justifiable complaints. We get a great many telephone calls every day. Our telephone calls in our office have gone as high as 300 a day for all divisions within my office.
I'm just trying to get a handle on how
yes.
much of this would be covered by this statute.
The source of... I guess what we have to look at, Mr. Chairman, is that when we get to the bottom line of those 4,200 files that we've closed, when we find that we've closed 70% of those in favor of the consumer, then I feel those were legitimate complaints. And sometimes it's not easy to see when it starts out with whether it's a justifiable complaint or not. We're just open to there are many, many areas that we get calls that, frankly, maybe aren't even under my jurisdiction, but we can help people by having them go talk to someone else that we can tell them where to get some help. But it's primarily written communications where they express a grievance. So if we would want to call it a complaint, maybe not.
Mr. Chairman, who's being protected by these files being closed? Who are we protecting?
I feel that in most instances, we're protecting two people. We're complaining. The person who is has an inquiry in health insurance, for example. I think we're protecting the individual making the complaint because they really do not want their health records to be open to the public. We have had many instances, for example, when someone has filed a complaint against an insurance company on a health claim, and their doctor has come to us and said, hey, that person doesn't know, but they have a certain illness, and they're not aware of it. So we have to be so careful.
You would suggest then, much like the rest of the law, exempting health insurance records from this?
Well, I would suggest exempting all insurance department records.
I can tell you're resisting the bill, but I'm curious about how do you keep it in line with the philosophy of the whole open records section of the law, which does exempt medical records. And certainly you can make, I think, a reasonable case under the existing statute that medical records should be exempted.
Let's take the instance of a professional liability claim against a doctor or a hospital or that type of thing. Of course, we do have, I think there's another bill that's going to try and open those records to the public record also.
They would be in the court record if
only
a lawsuit
when there's
occurs.
Only when there's a lawsuit. But there's that area before that lawsuit is filed that may be the determining factor of whether or not there's going to be.
Who's the other person being protected?
My source of information. Primarily,
okay.
the state of Oregon, in that a lot of people that complain to me or make my office aware of problems out in the field that would not do so if they knew that their names would be made public.
So it's the complainant in a health insurance case and the source of the of information, your sources of information,
my source
you'd like
of information
to protect?
I'd like to protect.
And which is your complaint, all complainants then, you say, are the people being protected by this?
Well, not all.
Okay.
But some of them are very willing to have their name shown as complaining against someone, but I feel that what we want to do is not to discourage someone from coming to me with a problem that they may suspect, for example. There's a section 746.600, which is the use and disclosure of insurance information that goes into quite, in our trade practices, that's quite lengthy as to, we have certain requirements as to the underwriting information, for example, and there are a number of things. I just feel this is a too sensitive an area to have our files made public. And Mr. Chairman, I don't really know what useful purpose would be served by this legislation.
Further questions for Commissioner?
Yes, I do. You can't think of any useful purpose for this information at all? I mean...
No, I really don't, for an individual to come
in. If I wanted to know if, as a consumer, which is why I assume this bill is here, if I want to know if insurance company X has problems in an area like misrepresentation, shouldn't I be able to find out if there have been a significant number of claims against that company for misrepresentation or for poor service, which I think is probably what it's all about, or claim settlement or claim delay or claim denial, if you've got one where you're just getting consistent complaints and perhaps not actionable, but as a consumer, isn't that information I would want, isn't that information you'd like to have?
Okay.
As Mr. you
Chairman, the under our laws, we have a section that says, that requires companies to comply with certain claim settlement practices. And if there is a violation of that, and I suppose that my office and I make the determination whether there has been a practice that a company will indeed violate the Fair Claim Settlement Practices, then we call a hearing and take action against them and fine them. That is public record at that point. And if someone wants to come to my office and say, have you taken any action for violations against a certain company, then we would be very happy to show them those records.
Okay.
That is available, and I feel that at that point, then we have determined this has been a practice of this company and they should be made public record. And
Chair,
it is.
Are those fairly accessible records that you're describing right now?
Yes. Any time that we call a hearing on a company or take any action, there is a file in our office that is accessible to the public.
How long would it take me to get information on one of those files or to look at one of those files?
Right.
About 30 seconds.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you.
The shipwreck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is, I'm Representative Bob Shiprack from House District 23 in Clackamas County. And I'm here today testifying in favor of House Bill 2847 for maybe some unique reasons. I'm on a member of the State and Federal Affairs Committee where we recently held testimony on Senate Bill 17 relating to licensing of insurance agents. That's not the issue in House Bill 2847. However, many of the things that you're discussing here today were brought up in that committee and were concerns of many of the members of that committee. And perhaps I can relay some of the impressions that some of us on that committee had. Frankly, I was kind of, as a newcomer to the legislature, in awe of the ability of a poor bill such as that to steamroll its way through this legislature. And I kind of want to follow it up and see what happens over on this bill.
Wait, Bob, by the way, where is Senate Bill 17?
It's on the governor's desk. It's passed the Senate and the House. It's all done.
Let me see, where was the bill?
That was in State and Federal Affairs.
How come?
Because it was a sunset law.
Oh, it must be
it's a sunset, their licensing
that's right.
law.
That's right.
We were prepared for that bill, a staff sunset review on insurance agent licensing and adjuster licensing. And, of course, most of the testimony or research in this deals with that area. However, there are some very good points that are important to look at in regards to House Bill 2847, specifically in the area of complaints. Of the more than 15,000 written complaints received in the last 3 years, nearly 75% have been classified as valid. Most are filed against authorized insurance companies, with some 20 to 30% against licensed agents. Complaints against independent adjusters account for only about 1% of the total. Interesting statistic. It goes through, and I'd hope that you'll get copies of this. I don't have them. I talked to Sue Wilson, who prepared this a couple days ago, and we discussed her experiences in researching in this area. And she had about as much luck as a consumer would in trying to get into the consumer records. She had to take the statistics given her, basically. And I think that the record shows that there is a tremendous amount of valid complaints being filed against insurance companies in the state of Oregon. These aren't simple telephone calls, but written, valid complaints that are simply not being acted on. And I'd like to point out to you that the
Representative
Go ahead.
Representative Shiprock, can you give us the number that have been filed and the number that haven't been acted on?
Oh, I wouldn't have that, Bob. Representative Harper.
And you're making that.
I have with me I guess that's the reason for the bill. We don't know what's going on. All we have are the written valid complaints that we received in the other committee. I don't know if you've got this. This is a complete breakdown of the type of complaints and 1982, 4,206, averaging about 450 a month. You know, that's a good question, Representative Harper. I don't know. I don't know if the insurance commissioner's office knows, if they even keep records of that. But the thing that I'd like to impress upon people in consideration of this bill is that the law states that the purpose of the insurance code is to protect the insurance buying public. That is the purpose of the code. And the insurance commissioner's office is empowered to enforce that code. It is not set up to protect the insurance industry. That is not the intent of the law. Unfortunately, it's one person's opinion that it looks to me like that's what's happening. Again, looking through this, out of those 4,200 complaints, in 1981, there was action taken disciplinary action, for 18 cases in all those. I'm just going to keep this brief. I hope that this committee gets better answers than your State and Federal Affairs Committee got. I couldn't get my answers satisfied, or questions satisfied, and I would just hope that you can keep at it and come up with something good. And I'd also like to say that I'm having an amendment drafted, which in my opinion would help solve this situation by having an arbitrator perhaps settle these disputes much quicker than are currently being done at the current time. And hopefully the Oregon consumer can get a little bit better response out of this department.
Representative Jones.
Representative Shiprack,
mm-hmm.
Let me ask a couple of questions because there's some comments that you've made that I'm not sure where you've come to determine that. You indicated that you think maybe an arbitrator would be appropriate to get better consumer information or protection settling the claims. Now, you indicated faster. Are you saying that they're not being settled in a timely manner?
Exactly.
What, you have information to provide us this regarding
was,
that?
This was the comments of, in fact, a couple people on our committee who have had this very same problem. It was their experience that in any claims less than $100, many companies just simply try and beat you out of it. These will go for months on end.
Are you talking about the companies or the commissioner's office not taking action on them? Now, which are we talking
both.
About?
Both. There's a claim filed. There's a valid claim filed.
Mm-hmm.
Valid complaint filed. And there's also, naturally, the consumer is going to be pestering the company. And these will drag out for months. In one case, it was 9 months. Another case, it was a year. This was of two members of the committee, our colleagues. There were no, unfortunately, in our hearings, there were no consumer groups present to testify on this bill. It went through so fast. It was.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hunter.
Thank you. Representative Shiprack, if you look at line 9 of the bill, the descriptive.
I don't know. Want to read it?
My question, is it the intent in having a descriptive summary of the complaint, including a description of the resolution of the complaint, is it the intent of this bill to disclose for the public record a matter only after it has been resolved, that is, whether favorably or unfavorably? There were some comments here earlier about unfounded allegations, and my question is, would this, the intent of this bill only be to have the complaint and resolution in the record rather than putting it in as it goes along?
Well, Representative Hanlon, it would be my interpretation of line 9 that when a complaint was filed, it would then be registered, and when there was a resolution, if any, it would then be entered on it. That's my understanding of the current in other system where it's done.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Hunt.
Representative Shiprack, I have heard you, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, charge the labor or the insurance commissioner with dereliction of duty and follow-up complaints. Is that what you have said?
I think that it's that they are not working in the best interest of the consumers of Oregon.
You know, other than what you think, do you have any statistics,
mm-hmm.
any cases that would lead us to believe that you might be right?
Well, we could if we had this bill, we'd know better. Unfortunately, we can't. All we can go by are the meager statistics that are given to us, Representative Harper. And when we've got valid complaints averaging over, well, in this case, approximately 450 a month, little documented disciplinary action. And obviously that there are consumers out there that are upset with what's going on, I think it's reasonable to assume that something is not right. And I think that we should work, it's a duty of this legislature to investigate that. And that's one of the reasons we're here today.
Maybe we can, Representative Jones.
You through. Representative Harper.
Representative Jones.
Representative Shipwreck, have you ever dealt in an agency or a company that dealt with consumer complaints?
Have I ever?
Have you ever worked for or worked with an agency that dealt with consumer complaints?
Never.
Consumers complain about a variety of things, many of which are not valid and can be resolved. Mm-hmm. I think my concern is the assumption, and I don't know whether the agency is currently doing a good job or not, but I have a great deal of concern for an allegation that says they are because of the number.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I think we need to ask some more questions, and I guess your committee did not have an opportunity to do that, or did not have the commissioner before you to be able to ask those questions. And I think with what you've asked, we need to get the commissioner back in, because when you talk about 4,000 complaints, you have to relate that to the amount of business, as I recall. Mm-hmm. That would be a very invalid statistic without it. Do you know the volume of business or the number of agents or the number of, other than 1,400 businesses that do business in Oregon, I understand?
Yeah, there's a testimony, and it's in here, there's about 16,000 licensed agents in the state.
16,000
approximately,
licensed agents?
Yeah.
And 1,400 insurance companies.
She
gave us that statistic.
That may be true. I don't doubt that.
So that would be approximately 3 per company in a year.
Yes, that'd be...
If you did an average, that'd be 3 per company
Sure.
Year.
Yes.
Okay, I guess then that's what I'm saying. I mm-hmm. didn't know if you had that information, but...
Oh, yeah.
The assumption of misrepresentation or when you deal with consumer complaints is not necessarily valid in my mind. And
mm-hmm. I understand your comments, Representative Jones.
What we can do probably, Bob, is maybe if you have some of those complaints that you know of that have been ruled not in favor of the complainant, that we go to the commissioner and see what's being done. So we can do that. But just for the fairness to the people that have come here to testify on the following bill, the auto repair and replacement bill, we want to go on this bill till 2:45. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, the final comment. We know the complaints. They're printed in front of us. And I think it's, you have to ask yourself, the commissioner's office knows the complaints. They obviously then know who the complaints are filed against. It's on computers. And it's so I reject the statement that it can't be done. It can certainly be done. And it's just a question of...
No, she said,
really
I think she said it.
She
could
said
be
it
done.
Would cost.
I hope so.
Can I ask one question?
Yeah, okay. Representative Boone.
Representative, then you heard her... Did you hear her fiscal analysis
mm-hmm.
around 39? Are you willing to support a tax increase to help her out?
Do you believe?
Yeah, I think I've worked with them a long time, and they have always been extremely helpful to me. I've never had bad news.
Representative DeBoer, that brings up another topic that we discussed in your state and federal affairs committee that I heard today a lot, is that we're understaffed. I talked to the committee chairman of that Ways and Means Committee, and they were not asked for additional help in that area. And therefore, they were not given those additional employees. So you have to wonder, you know, how committed are they to resolving these problems of consumer complaints when they didn't even ask for the additional manpower?
I just guess I have to tell you that in the last probably 2 years, I've called personally that office and had my constituents from Jackson County call and maybe turned 20, 25 people, and every one of those people got some results and got mm-hmm. it. What I thought in a fairly timely manner. And I just guess it's one of the few places that I've worked with, and quite frankly, and state government, that I've had some people that really responded and seemed to care about my constituents. And I guess that's one of the reasons I have a problem with the bill.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Just a comment briefly is that, number one, you have to accept that fiscal analysis as one that reflects the real needs given this problem being posed in the bill.
Yes.
And I, aside from what Brother Shiprack says, Representative Shiprack says, I would suspect that this bill has nothing to do with consumer complaints. It in fact just says we are going to open records. It does not deal with questions of whether or not they're effective in their agency. It just says we'd like to know. He's saying we'd like to know, are they being affected? Let us see the records. Believe me, as a newspaper man, that's one of the great frustrations.
Ah, that's the problem.
And then we know.
And you don't even want to pay to look at them. I just heard
certainly
that.
Certainly not, nor to copy them.
Okay. No further questions. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Brother Bob.
Brother Bob.
Pam Ferreira and Jen. Emily, could you come together?
Where do you find your brother?
I'll tell ya. Find him over here.
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairperson, and members, distinguished members of this committee, thank you again for the opportunity to discuss this issue. The reason we are here and to support this group, or to support this measure, I represent approximately, well, exactly 1,542 people that have claims against General Motors for defective General Motors diesel automobiles. Those persons have had, or the members of our group have had some ranges from very little problems, some minor irritations, to some repair bills. In one case, of $13,500 paid for by the claimant. It's not uncommon to have repair bills in the $3,000 price range. Some of us have had all our repairs paid for. Those that have made a lot of noise and have early on generally had better luck than those that just took the cars in and paid the bill as they came. One of the reasons we support this measure is presented by Osberg and have offered our own amendments, which you have in your hand is proposed amendments to House Bill 2793, and there are no other identifiers on the right-hand corner. It's blank. Is that these proposed House bill will give a vehicle for consumers to get together with the manufacturer and try to resolve the difficulties short of litigating. At our own experience, we have found that several attorneys, or most attorneys, in our experience, have been reticent to take on General Motors just by the sheer sight and size of the corporation. I personally didn't have the funds to go to battle with General Motors when we were looking at a $10,000 to $20,000 fee for litigation, and that is cost for discovery, not attorney's fees. The attorneys that I had talked to were willing, if they could, to take the cases on a contingency fee basis. But it's still the costs that could come up were beyond my resources and most members' resources of our group. Right now, there are 31 states, other than the five that have already passed so-called, let's put it another way, defective automobile legislation. There are 31 states that are now considering similar measures. You also have a copy of the California measure in front of you and the Connecticut. The California bill is 4 pages. The Connecticut is 2, and those have already passed. We don't want a free ride. We want manufacturers to address the problems reasonably well with their product. In other words, the product should reasonably perform the mission for which it was manufactured. And in these cases, after specifically with our group, we have found that this particular case has fallen far short of any reasonable use of the automobile. We have worked with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association in presenting this measure. We still have some differences. However, I'm very optimistic that we can resolve those differences, and I believe that they're operating in good faith to present a measure that would be acceptable to this committee and to the legislature to pass an act that would protect the consumer and the Automobile Dealers Association and the manufacturer. Now, we're not looking for a free ride. We feel that if there's a defective automobile and that the automobile has failed the test, in other words, it's been down 30 calendar days or out of service within the first year, or it has four incurable defects of a major system such as an engine or transmission or some system of that sort, that there should be some recourse to either have the manufacturer buy back the automobile or replace with a comparable new and unused product. Now, I say comparable new and unused. If it's just comparable, I can get another lemon that someone else, or another defective product that someone else turned in. But what we're looking at is that the reasonable charge for the use where they had quite enjoyment of the product, and we're not trying to stick it to the manufacturer or to the dealer. We many members of our Dieselgate group are businessmen, and they have empathy. And we're not out here trying to just pass another law when there might not really be a need for it. We believe there is a genuine need for this bill for consumer protection. I made the point on the remedies, on the return, and the refunds. And I also made the point on the four or more times of a defect. There's a third thing that we would like would be the any consumer who prevails in an action brought under this act shall be entitled to recover reasonable attorney's fees and costs at trial on appeal to be awarded by the court. We feel that's a very, very necessary part of the act. It also would do another thing, and I believe that it would probably keep any arbitration proceedings more in line in good faith, or probably more apt to be satisfactorily resolved in the event there is some real and catastrophic failures with the automobile. The
John.
May I interrupt you at this point? I believe now that I think this is clear. Is this your amendment?
That's correct.
Okay. You indicated that you were working or attempting to work with the other proponents of amendments on the bill.
That's a point of disagreement, that particular part.
That's a... Oh, I was going to say, you're not disagreeing with what I said.
No,
with what you said.
I'm sorry.
That's what I was just going to ask you. Which of the measures that you find are in your portion of the amendments disagree at this point? Where are your bones of contention?
There are several.
Just briefly.
I'd be quite honest with you. We're going over that again earlier this morning. Can I see your four there? I just lost my four copy here. I need four.
Can you just give me the concepts? I don't
Yes.
even have to point them out. Just tell me the concepts where you differ.
We differ on the motor vehicle being new or used. I'm not so sure that that's still a point. We would like to see an implied warranty as well as expressed warranty in the bill, and that's in ours.
And these were where the differences occur, right?
The major differences, yes.
Uh-huh, okay.
Then one of the recommendations was for 6 months to pursue any remedies. We would like to have that from 2 years from the date of purchase, in other words, 1 year after any warranty had expired or 12,000 miles. They have 6 months.
Litigation?
Yes. Within 2 years from the date of delivery of the automobile.
Okay.
We would like to see the after the fourth defect, providing the manufacturer had been provided written notice that these remedies would apply. Okay.
Okay. What you're saying is you do not see a need to go to a board or to anyone in between. You want to go direct to the manufacturer. Is that what you're saying?
No.
On the fourth occurrence.
On the fourth, the way this reads is that there should be prior direct written notification from the consumer to the manufacturer. And the way I understand this, the interpretation of this would be that after four defects, they would still have one more shot at it. So they end up with five. Now, I understand that the manufacturer should have an opportunity to go in and correct a defect if three different dealers or four different dealers had not done satisfactory work. And it may be shoddy mechanics work, for instance. So they shouldn't be penalized for that. But the notice should be able to be given and the entire be prior to the fourth defect and the entire act be implemented to include the arbitration proceeding on the fourth defect.
So you're looking for the arbitration to take place at the fourth defect,
mm-hmm.
a notification with the to the manufacturer?
Yes.
Okay. Can I ask one last question, Mr. Chairman?
Go ahead.
Regarding your organization, did I not read recently in the media through electronic or printed that the case that the Dieselgate has with General Motors has been settled?
No, that's incorrect. It has not been settled.
All right, is it in litigation?
We're in a negotiation process, ma'am, where we have signed and negotiated an agreement with General Motors to go through an arbitrating procedure which tolls the statute of limitations. In other words, time out has been taken. So the statute of limitations is not running. So that if in fact we're not, we still have some major grievances, then we could go to court and not be penalized for that. We also are not under the agreement going to go after them again for money is already paid. In other words, there are people that are receiving funds for repairs. We've had a doctor in Vancouver that's a member of this group received $5,600. Some people in Canby, $3,500 for out-of-pocket expenses, which brings up...
Okay, so what you're telling me is it has not yet been settled, but it has been a negotiated agreement to go into arbitration.
Yes.
Thank you.
I have one other point on differences, if you want to hear it.
Okay.
The point is we're talking about collateral cost, and one of those... What we think is necessary is that we've had several people that have been stranded away from their home and have had to pay for motel fees, air transportation, and other things, and we feel that they should be reimbursed for that. And in some cases, some of our members of our consumer organization have been paid lost wages, travel, motel fees.
Questions for Mr. Campbell or for Susan? Question, Mr. Campbell. Are you an attorney?
No, sir.
Are you president of this organization?
Am I what?
What is your office in that diesel organization?
My wife and I are the founders. I'm the president. We work together with six other families.
How many members you said you had?
1,542 at last count, and we're continually getting calls on new members.
Okay.
Yes.
We have probably roughly 100 people out of state that belong to our group.
Yeah, okay, go ahead. Representative Wood.
Okay. I made an error here that Mr. Locke just pointed out, that after they've had on the defects, the four attempts to correct the defect, and that's what I fully intended to say. I'm a little nervous.
What I thought I understood was that on the fourth attempt to correct the defect, that at that point you would like to be able to go to arbitration.
Yes, and implement some of the remedies provided for in this act.
I just want to know a little more about Dieselgate. Then you're the president, you and your wife. It's not a paying job. No, it is not.
We've worked on this essentially full time for over a year. We started this July 4th, 1981.
And so this is just something you do as a volunteer part time thing.
Turned out that way, yes.
Turned out that way. Okay, thank you.
I just kind of wanted to ask Sue, based on the philosophy of Osprey, why are you not agreeing with Mr. Campbell on promoting his further amendments? Or am I wrong
that you're not?
Yeah, we support Mr. Campbell.
Oh, yes.
But you supported the bill as it was amended.
Right.
We were still rewriting this, working on rewriting the amendments this morning, and so that's why I think the wording of what you have before you could be a little unclear. But we are in agreement with what we support.
To clarify that a little bit.
Would you recognize yourself for the record, please?
To clarify that a little bit, if I may.
Would you
Identify yourself. I'm Tom Savage. I'm the Willamette coordinator for the Lemon Law Project for Osprey. To clarify that a little bit, basically the original bill isn't a very effective bill. We support the proposed amendments, the -4 amendments, as a basis for discussion, but we also agree with Mr. Campbell here on his amendments as well.
Did Mr. Campbell, apparently from what I'm getting from you, that you've all come in with this new proposal and you have signed off on it, saying, yes, we support that. Merle, did you propose your amendments when everybody was getting together to discuss the new bill? Did you propose your amendments at that time?
Yes, verbally, not in writing. My attorney had these drafted and I picked them up last night and we brought them down this morning. We discussed some of these issues in great detail, and there's some objections to both sides to coming to terms on certain issues. I think we're closer together this morning than we were yesterday, and you can correct me, Rich, if I'm mistaken. Is he still in the audience here? Mm-hmm. Are we closer together?
May we ask him that question later?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Campbell, would it be fair to say that there may be a little bit further movement on coming to agreement after this meeting here today? Is that what I'm hearing from...
From my position at this point, I believe that would be true. There are some certain things in here that I know that they're going to have some great heartburn about. And, you know, so we need to discuss those issues.
Okay. Any further questions for Representative Harper?
I guess my question is about the problem. And I guess my question, and I'll have to explain why I asked it a little bit. I bought my first General Motors car in 1947. And I haven't driven any car since then, no more than 4 years. I haven't had a limit problem. So it makes me wonder when I see such statements, there is no question that defective automobiles constitute a consumer problem. The lemon problem is substantial. And then down here, then Oregonians filed 156 complaints. How many automobiles were sold in Oregon in 1981?
No, I don't know. But I can say this. I think through the documentation of those complaints, and I think through the existence of Mr. Campbell and his organization, it does testify to the fact that there are certain problems. I think we're agreeing, but we don't think that by any means that most of the cars coming out are faulty cars. And the overall vast majority of these cars are quality cars. The only disagreement we might have is in that rare occasion when a faulty automobile does happen, we feel that there should be some responsibility by the manufacturer for the cost of those vehicles.
Then the problem is more perceived than real.
No. I think the existence of Mr. Campbell's.
May I address the committee one more time here? Since we have been in the media and people have looked at us to be all things as far as consumer complaints with automobiles have gone, we've had complaints from folks that have owned other automobiles or from foreign manufacturers and from other product line out of General Motors. Now, I have never had a defective or a lemon automobile before in my life out of, and this, I believe, is my 20th automobile. And I have two cars that have gone 150,000 miles. I was 26 when I purchased one of them. I'm 43 now, and I still drive it. I was 30 when I purchased the other, and I still drive it with virtually no problems. When I started having problems with this automobile, I took delivery. It had approximately 7 miles on it. The first time it went back to the dealer was 26 or 27 miles, and I've lost count after about 30 trips to the dealer for defects. So I don't believe there's anything under the hood that's attached to the engine that's original. That's all. And as I've added the cost of the repairs that the factory and the dealer has paid for, and they exceed my purchase price of the automobile. Now, some people have not been as vocal as I have been and have paid those repairs out of pocket. Now, I think that's unconscionable product failure when that happens. And prior to the formation of this group and a similar group in Seattle, we were told that you've got to be responsible for your own maintenance, and our folks are having catastrophic, expensive failures that interfere with their personal life and their professional life. We have a doctor that's let this thing overcome him to such a degree that affected his performance, and he was fired from his job. Now, we're not, that's a personal problem, but those are cases of things that are happening, that have happened in this particular case. And I could go on and on, and it's not a play for sympathy. It's a relation of some actual problems that are actually occurring. Now, different people are handling these situations differently. Some folks just got rid of their cars, you know, 3 months down the road or whatever. One automobile that I know of had 11 head gasket failures. The person that bought that secondhand from the dealer is now in our group.
Go ahead, Jones.
One little very minor question, and that is on page 2 of your testimony, Sue, mm-hmm. you indicate that the period of time for reports was from July 1, 81 to June 30th of 83. Since that has not yet been reached, what date is that?
Oh, I'm sorry, I believe that must be 82.
Is that right? Was it 82?
82. 1 year.
Okay. Thank you.
Sue, were they complaints about new vehicles, or do you have any way of breaking that?
Those complaints haven't been classified as to the specific nature of the vehicles, and so I couldn't really tell you.
Okay, we have to go on now with the other people that want to testify. I want to thank you for coming.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your indulgence.
Rich Keeson. You want to come with Jim?
Or? Mr. Chairman, if I could.
Yeah.
Jim Austin is here from the Motor Vehicle Manufacturers Association, and perhaps he'd like to join me at the table.
When are you going, Jim?
For the record, I'm Rich Keister with the Oregon Auto Dealers Association, and we represent the franchised automobile and truck dealers here in Oregon. Our interest simply, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, is in the legislation is that there is in fact a lemon law in existence nationally under the Uniform Commercial Code, excuse me, with the exception of Louisiana, which operates under a separate system. However, the problem is that if a consumer is disgruntled and wants to file an action, they must, under the Uniform Commercial Code, file against the dealer as the seller. This puts the dealer in kind of an untenable position, as much as we're defending ourselves against the consumer and saying perhaps the car is not a defective or a full lemon. And then if we are not successful in that kind of an action, in order for us to recover, we have to turn around and file an action against our manufacturer, which of course, as you know, is also the one that issues the franchise under which we operate. So simply, our interest in the legislation is that it would make it clear who issues the warranty and where the action would be taken under the warranty. Perhaps either Mr. Austin or Mr. Ridgway is here with me also from General Motors can speak to the specifics of the proposed bill that you have or the amendments to the bill. And I would say that we have had several conversations and at some length with Mr. Campbell and an assistant to Representative Springer, and they've worked very well with us. We can support the amendments here. I've only just earlier this afternoon seen Mr. Campbell's other amendments and wouldn't be prepared to speak to them today.
Thank you, Rick. Do you have Jim or?
Okay, fine. Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Jim Austin. As I signed up on the sign-in sheet, I indicated our opposition to this issue. I, along with Mr. Ridgway, have been involved with this thing for some 4 years or so in California and several other states. We find ourselves basically opposed to it because we feel that the industry some 4 years ago on a voluntary basis recognized the need and the problems that exist between the consumer and the manufacturer, including the dealer. We established a program, a third-party mechanism program, to hopefully expedite and provide solutions to this and remedies to the cars that aren't functioning properly. We also realize that this is an emotional issue for people, a frustrating issue for those people who have defects in their cars and aren't getting them properly taken care of. That's why, as I indicated, on a voluntary basis, we implemented the program as is somewhat outlined in the legislation. And we'd like to see that type of program continue and would continue to support it without hopefully having to have legislation to put it into the statutes. But in fact, if this Oregon legislature decides that they want to do that, we find that we, through the proposed amendments as you have before you now, that we can basically work within the framework that's outlined in these amendments. Should we go on and discuss sections of this, or how?
Whatever.
How should we?
Go ahead.
Okay. In the proposed amendments that you have before you, the section number one.
Which one are you talking about?
House Bill 2793-4.
Dash 4, okay.
Yes. I think that's what I'm talking about. In section number one, it relates to defining the consumer, and I believe that language is taken from the Federal Trade Commission language of a consumer good, that being an item which is used for personal, family, or household purposes. Section number two relates to the provisions of the bill that say that if a motor vehicle does not conform to all the express manufacturer's warranties, that the person has a right to return and get the defect corrected within 1 year or 12,000 miles, whichever happens first. And also it goes on to say that these repairs will be made by the manufacturer or his agent, even though the expiration of the term of 1 year, 12,000 miles has in fact passed. Section number 3 of the bill states that if a manufacturer, agent, or authorized dealer is unable to conform the motor vehicle to the applied express warranties, the manufacturer shall, number one, replace the vehicle with a comparable motor vehicle, or refund to the consumer his full purchase price plus any taxes, license, registration fees that he may have incurred.
At the manufacturer's choice of either of those?
Yes. That being, in the event that a comparable motor vehicle is not available. It goes on to say in that section that refunds will be made to the consumer and also any lien holder, if in fact that one exists. It also provides in Section 3 an affirmative defense for the manufacturer if there's been any abuse, neglect, or unauthorized modifications or alterations to the vehicle. Section 4.
Mr. Chairman, may I interrupt?
Representative, yeah.
On 3A, can you give us an example of such a nonconformity for the record?
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Under Section 3A, can you give us an example for the purposes of the record of such a nonconformity that doesn't impair the use and market value?
Okay. In a replacement of it?
Under lines 13 through 15, the sub A, the affirmative defense of the manufacturer.
Oh.
That a nonconformity, give us an example of a nonconformity that doesn't impair the use and market value of a vehicle. I'm just trying to put that in the record. I'm not sure what it is.
Well, if the person thought there was a sound that was irritating or something like that, a part of the car that the radio isn't working properly or something like that.
Thanks.
Section 4.